From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today, the 10th installment in a series of discussions with Professor Luciana Bone about the construction of the Soviet state and economy. Luciana, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Don.
So, where were we picking up today?
Today, I thought we would talk about fascism, because last time we talked about the organization of the international communist parties into a united front to face the threat of fascism. Mm. So perhaps we should talk about what it is, what it was,
right,
and so on.
Right. What were they fighting? Because we're hearing the word bandied about an awful lot today, and of course, fascism isn't like McDonald's, where you walk in and you get the same exact burger no matter whether you buy it in Tokyo or Long Island. And there are things that are very unique to both the social, cultural, political history, and also the level of development of the economy. Almost every variable brings something new.
Yeah, exactly my point. You saved me the trouble of going into that. Fascism is not a formula. Fascism has national characteristics, just like socialism does.
Right.
So, but this morning I wanted to start by referring to the speech by Trump, which I haven't heard in entirety, by Trump at the UN General Assembly.
Right.
Okay. So this is a subjective interpretation, but it leads me into the topic that I want to discuss. Mm. So it seems that from what I read of the parts of his speech, that at the UN General Assembly, Trump attacks what he calls the red tape of international organization. He must be referring directly to the United Nations. And in my view, he's really saying that the growing influence of emerging powers in these international organizations, I mean, this growing power, this growing influence is simply unacceptable to Washington, especially China's. It seems to me that it is the rejection of multilateralism, mm-hmm, in favor of American hyper-sovereignty of the world,
right,
and that there are enemies that lurk everywhere, that was clear. Now, I really don't want to say that Trump is unique in this. I think he's the continuation of, in his own form, of a recurring theme since the fall of the Soviet Union.
Even earlier. I mean, you can go back to the McCarthy period, for example, where people, even like Richard Nixon at that time, were talking, mm-hmm, about get the U.S. out of the U.N. and the U.N. out of the U.S. They're basically, when you're looking at someone who looks at the world as, you know, being their own personal oyster, any other organization that isn't an agent of that is a competitor and unacceptable. And I think that's a trend,
right,
that runs all the way through every administration from the creation of the United Nations to date, pretty much.
And intensified after the fall of the Soviet Union.
Yes, indeed. Yep.
Yeah. No, I perfectly agree with you on that. Yes, to support your point, this speech asserts what I call U.S. dogma, that is, that the world is American property.
Yep.
It just belongs to the United States.
Yep.
And this is the idée fixe of foreign policy, as we mentioned, throughout all presidents, and especially intensified since 1990. But what I want to underline here is that as a single goal, as an overarching aim, and it is an unacknowledged one, this desire to conquer the world is a fascist trait.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's what I want before I go into what is fascism.
Right.
And then there's another recurring fascist trait in Trump's speech. He says, if the righteous many don't confront the wicked few, evil will triumph. Well, this mm-hmm. is Bush all over again.
Yeah,
and,
right. You're either with us or against us. You're with us or against us. Yeah,
right. Sorry, what did you say?
Bush, you're with us or against us.
Yeah. So, and this is the tactic of fascism. It's fear-mongering. We are surrounded. We are encircled by evil. The language of America is always biblical. You know, what
yeah.
evil is something that you read in I don't know, Beowulf. You know what I mean?
Right, no, right.
It's really il male in Italian. Nobody appeals to that. It just sounds so Stone Age. But anyway, it's just my opinion. Now, I go into exploring the term fascism. And the first thing I want to say is that fascism is not a revolutionary movement. It is a reactionary movement. Really, its aim is to curtail and set back democracy, even liberal democracy, and especially the kind of democracy that empowers people, workers' rights, ethnic rights, women's rights, etc. And the most important thing, the second thing I want to warn people against or advise them to do is to dismiss the word totalitarian. Mm. Now, there are several reasons for doing this, but the first reason is that totalitarianism does not provide a class analysis.
Right.
And it is a word that is beloved by bourgeois rhetoric.
You know, and not for nothing. I mean, it's one of those words like corruption, for example, that's used
yes.
in politics that lacks an apparent ideological framework or certainly a class analysis, but actually is very heavily ideological. For example, totalitarian was used to describe socialist countries, and the idea of totality there being that not just the administration of the state, but the administration of the economy was carried out by the state. So in other words, all power was in the hands of the state, total control, totalitarianism.
Yeah.
But in fact, you know, I've had this conversation with Dmitry Babich. You could make, and he makes a very strong argument, you could make the argument that the U.S. and EU is the most totalitarian construct that's ever existed. If you look at the range of power, I mean, their whole total information awareness project, for example, knowing everything about everybody, et cetera, that is totalitarianism also, and it's never spoken of that way.
Absolutely, and that's exactly my point. One of the dangers, the ultimate result of this term is that it equates fascism and socialism. I mean,
right.
besides being meaningless because it covers everything, I'm going to look at the Britannica definition and see how exactly ideological it is, as you say.
Right.
And the result of the word totalitarianism yesterday, for example, the result is that there is an equation between fascism and communism.
Right.
And yesterday I looked at a lecture for third middle school in Italy, where the teacher, it's a very good, you know, for a middle school history class, it's very good, but nevertheless, the teacher says that fascism is a totalitarian system, and she gives example of Nazi Germany and Stalin's Soviet Union. This is apparently, common knowledge now.
Right.
Supposedly.
Yeah.
I was astonished, it's in the textbooks. It's truth, it's knowledge, but it's false knowledge.
Yeah.
So if we look at the Britannica definition, it says totalitarianism is a form of government that theoretically, I don't know why they add that permits no individual freedom. So you immediately see the ideological project there. The individual freedom
right.
is the highest of all freedoms. And
right.
that's, of course, bourgeois idea of freedom.
Right.
And then it continues that seeks to subordinate all aspects of individual life to the authority of the state. Okay, but you can't say that. So the Soviet Union was interested in feeding people, housing people, treating people, educating people.
Right.
Right? It wasn't just interested in freedom of the speech, freedom of the press, which we don't even have.
Right, exactly.
Right?
Right. I mean, that's the point is that, they were dealing in abstractions. The reality
yes.
is that the actual, struggle... here that was taking place was over who controls the means of production. And the theory was that in the West, the ownership was individual, personal, and diffuse. And in the socialist countries, it was the state. In other words, it was almost like a monarchy, where, in fact, it was more concentrated in the West and has become more concentrated than at any time in history in the West,
yeah.
Among the smallest class. Than it ever was in the Soviet Union.
Yeah. We are so educated to... Our perspective is idealist versus materialist. So mm-hmm. we think in abstractions, freedom, but not
right.
freedom from hunger.
Right.
So the difference between a bourgeois culture and a socialist or communist culture is the difference in a philosophical outlook, perspective. The bourgeoisie think in terms of ideas, and the socialists think in terms of material reality.
Right. Well... when you're peddling fantasy, that's how it has to go. some reality tests for someone.
That's right.
For example, if you want to make policy, okay, we have freedom here. And democracy. Try to make policy. Do something simple. Get a speed bump put on your street. You find out how much power you have. In Tripoli, in Libya, if you wanted to do that, what you did was go down on Tuesday to the General Assembly building, bring as many of your friends as you can, you raise it in the meeting, and you vote on it. And the people that showed up vote. And that's
yeah.
and then it gets put in. And of course, some guy can come by next week and bring his friends, and they vote it down, and they take it out. But that's freedom, and what we have isn't.
Exactly. Because we have all these ideas. Anyway, but amazingly, it was Benito Mussolini who coined the term totalitarian. I always thought it was first used by Trotsky in 1936, but no.
Nope,
it was Benito Mussolini. He coined the term totalitarian in the early 1920s. So it's a fascist term to characterize the new fascists, the new fascist state of Italy,
right.
which he further described as all within the state, none outside the state,
right.
none against the state.
Right.
This, to me, echoes something from my readings of St. Augustine in my masterpiece of Western literatures in college, where Augustine said, everything within the church, nothing outside the church.
Yep, it's
very against the church.
Very Catholic concept. Very Catholic.
Very
concept.
Catholic, very religious.
The one holy. One holy Catholic Apostolic Church.
Mm-hmm.
That's the state.
Isn't that? Yeah, and I think it was Domenico Lossurdo, the Italian philosopher, who goes into the meaninglessness of the term in the end, of the term totalitarianism, and says it has religious origins. And I see it now talking to you,
Well, I'm a Catholic schoolboy. I was raised with those concepts being poured into my head. But yeah, so you're right. I mean, so you have... You have that. So here we are. Now we're with Mussolini, and they're rolling out this project. Give us some of the ideological underpinnings, and also contextualize it. What was happening in Italy? And by the way, while he's talking about the state being all powerful, the state didn't exist all by itself. Somebody owned that too, didn't they? So we'll go back to class analysis here.
Yeah. Okay. Great. You make me skip to. Here in my outline, to the actual background, you know, the thing I know best is Italian fascism, because I grew up in the post-war, and one of the most accessible vehicles of anti-fascist propaganda was the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went over the fascist period. Forever, everybody,
right.
Every director, they would have all been in front of McCarthyism,
right.
You know, if they were American.
Right,
but
right.
We grew up until the 1980s. So here we go. Italian fascism. And you can interrupt. I plan that you can interrupt for analogies to the present situation.
No problem.
Okay. All right, so we start in 1918 in Italy. What happens there, that industry struggles to recover, and workers and farmers call for better working conditions, the 8-hour day, and better salaries. At the same time, I want to add here, for example, that in the United States, since the 1970s, industry has actually been deindustrialized. And we have no jobs, right?
Right.
So let's tick that off, you know, that we have a post-industrial world, we have a crisis in industrial production,
right.
We have precariats and all sorts of crazy contracts.
Yep.
American workers work an enormous amount of hours, etc., etc.
And we also have a long tradition of the United States, both because it was a rapidly developing capitalist country and then an imperial power. Of the workers expecting to do better from generation to generation, doing very well, relatively speaking, economically compared to workers in other countries, and a substantial middle class, all of which, you know, has either joined the precariat or the lumpen proletariat at this point in time. So
yes.
You have people that have a memory of things being good living in this misery.
Starting in 1948 and the GI... What's it called? The GI Bill?
GI Bill, all of that.
GI Bill?
Yep.
Yeah? That created the middle class.
Yep.
So, 1918, back to 1918, along with the dissatisfaction of the workers, we have the resentment of the nationalists.
Right.
These are the people, the nationalists, who, according to them, Italy was stabbed in the back at Versailles, which is also the theme in Germany.
Right. Germany, Austria, Hungary, and Italy were the Triple Alliance. They lost World War I to the Triple Entente, which were France, Russia, and the UK, although Russia dropped out.
Yeah. Italy joined...
They changed sides at the end. Yeah. Again.
The British-French alliance against Austria.
Yeah.
And so there was a victory, you know. I mean, Italy entered in 1915.
Right.
But nevertheless, it wanted territories. It wanted to take loot away from the Austrian Empire, namely northern Italy, the city of Trent and the region, and the sort of Germanic area of Bolzano, Bozen, and my own city, Trieste, and my own place of birth, Istria, which is a peninsula south of Trieste. So, but nevertheless, it was cheated of. They wanted Nice and they wanted Dalmatia for some reason, because it belonged to the Roman Empire. But anyway, they felt they were cheated of some promised territory. So there was the resentment of these nationalists. Now, the 1919-1920 period is called in Italy the Biennio Rosso, the Red Biennial. Is it biennial? 2 years. How do you say 2 years?
Yeah, biennial.
I mean, because it was thick with social agitations, the peasants occupy the lands, workers occupy the factories, social tensions were extremely high. I don't know if you can find an equivalent to this in the United States. I mean, we don't have workers' agitations, do we? But we have social tension of a racial nature. What would you say?
Which period are we talking about?
Well, we're talking about Italy 1919-1920, the Red Biennium.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if you would say that there is similar agitation in the United States as the result of this deindustrialization, would you say there is or there isn't?
You're talking about now or back then? Because back then,
Both. I really am talking now. I am looking at whether there is a framework for fascism in the United States.
Yeah, there is, but it's not to the same degree as in Italy and Germany. You have Versailles really driving Germany. You know, this is the abject, you know, condition of...
I would agree with you. Yeah. I mean, one of the reasons... We have social unrest, right? Violence of police...
Yeah, but you had, like in 1918, 1919 here in the United States when they started with the, you know, all the red, you know, the FBI,
the Palmer credit, grade,
you know, all that
grade,
stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So that was in response to both communist and socialist and also, what do you call it, anarchist you know, organizing and agitation.
Anarcho-syndicalists,
yeah, so there was. But in the U.S., you had this large middle class, and you had, you know, the beginning of suddenly Ford's manufacturing cars or jobs, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There was the workers' condition looked more up. It was easier to beat them into submission when they had a job tomorrow and you could pay them, and that was true for many people.
Yeah, that's right. So during this biennium in 1919, the Mussolini formed a nationalist movement, and it was then called, I don't know how to translate it, Fasci Italiani di Combattimento, literally Italian fasces, that is the bundle of wheat that symbolized popular power in Rome.
Right.
Of combattimento means struggle, so...
Right.
I didn't check the translation, but this is before the formation of the Italian Fascist National Party. Anyway, he founded this. Now Mussolini, before 1914, had been a socialist.
Right.
Anti-bourgeois or anti-capitalist party or were called social democrats and socialists, even the, you know, the Bolshevik Party was part of the socialist,
right,
social democrat movement in Europe.
Right.
But anyway, he had been a member of the Italian Socialist Party. But in 1914, as we know, the socialist parties of Europe decided to become nationalist and join,
right,
World War One for, right, their nations.
Right.
And it was sort of like proletarians of the world disunite and kill each other.
Right, exactly right. Yep.
And the only, and in the only, you know, one of the few, I mean, Rosa Luxemburg accused this and went to prison. Lenin was opposed, was desolated by this incredible choice, this formation of social democracy.
Well, and you had Eugene Debs here in the United States and others,
yep,
you know, doing the same thing. Yep.
Right. So, you know, they renounced internationalism and,
right,
and they died and killed. And they were the one, as you said before, who, yeah, did all the dying.
That's right.
Now, in 1919, this newborn movement of the Fasci Italiani had no success in the election. But in 1920, they undertook violent actions. Especially in the countryside of northern Italy, north and central Italy. These violent actions were carried out by squads. They were called squadristi. They were really bully squads, violent, you know, violent people.
Street gangs.
Who were charged with beating up peasants and communists and socialists. So the fascists enter into contact with landowners, business owners, members of the bourgeoisie who were frightened or were damaged by the strikes. And the fascists recruit sympathizers. They reach accords and direct the paramilitary squads, these squadristi, the beaters and punishers, against objectives such as the socialists and the farmers, etc., that they had agreed to target. Now, one of the most... you know, when the Odessa trade union building went up in flame.
Was burned, yeah, right, by the
in 2014.
By fascists. Yeah,
it Odessa. Reminded me of the first most, what you call it, spectacular act in Italy, which is never mentioned in history because it's so local, but it was huge. And this happened in Trieste, which is a border town, and was multicultural, minority of Slovenians, of Greeks, of Serbs. It was multicultural, but nevertheless, it was a strong nationalism because it had been just in 1918 annexed to Italy from Austria. And there, the fascists burned the House of Labor of the socialists. There was no killing, but it was an act of spectacular intimidation. So it reminded me, you know, when it happened, it brought back that history.
Well, and, you know,
but
that's...
What
you have going on, in essence, in each case, is an alliance of people who are, you know, of either working class or you know, some precariat between the middle class and working class, being, you know, in an alliance with the bourgeoisie, beating on workers and peasants to maintain the power of the bourgeoisie in a condition where that power is under threat. And
exactly.
That is the essence of the, you know, legs upon which
fascism
stands on, exactly. And I think that's where we'll pick it up next week, because I really want to, you know, plumb the depths of this thing and get to a point where we can start looking around, you know, the contemporary situation as well. And thank you so much for as much as we brought to it so far today. Luciana, we'll speak to you next week.
Thank you, Don, as always, and to your audience.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.